when did we actually as a society really want everybody to do well optimally? So I think the Indian state, what we do for the most vulnerable, I think is going to be key, because this number of the vulnerable is really increasing.
You are listening to In Pursuit of Development with Dan Banik.
India is experiencing a devastating second wave of the pandemic. Indeed, the country appears to be going through one of the darkest moments in its post-independence history, with new records broken every day for new cases of COVID-19. There are also growing concerns that even these staggering numbers that have been officially reported are in reality an undercount. And then there is the crippling shortage of life-saving supplies such as medical oxygen. Critics claim that the Indian government has ignored numerous red flags in recent months and disregarded scientific opinion. Thus, some have argued that Indians are now paying the price of government inaction, while others have pointed to the historical neglect by successive ruling parties to invest more in health. The image of India as a country experiencing rapid economic growth and lifting millions of people out of poverty has of late been replaced by pictures of funeral pyres. How did it come to this? And how capable is the Indian state at responding to major crises? My guest this week is Potrolekha Chatterjee, an award-winning journalist, columnist, and author who has written extensively on the role of economic, political, social, cultural, and educational factors in public health in India. We discussed political polarization, the role of democratic institutions, the agreements and disagreements on state planning and response, the challenges faced by a large number of people who rely on the informal economy for their livelihoods, and the role of elites in shaping the development discourse. It's great to have you on the show, Potrolekha. Welcome.
Thank you, Dan. It's great to be on your show.
You know, I wish we were speaking under better circumstances, because the whole world is now talking about the grim situation in India, and especially in India's capital city, New Delhi, where you live and where millions are living under lockdown conditions. And I was just reading earlier today, Arundhati Roy wrote this beautifully written piece saying that we're witnessing a crime against humanity. There's so much media attention on India's COVID catastrophe, as some have been describing it. And then, of course, ever since the onset of the COVID pandemic, most scholars and journalists like you, you've been highlighting the fact that policymakers must plan, must enforce, you know, access to affordable medicines. The livelihoods of many groups of people, especially in the informal economy, have been severely impacted. I've spoken to Tathagata Satpathy, one of the former MPs in India, last year when the lockdown was enforced with just 4 hours' notice. So there have been so many people really highlighting the kind of problems that Indians have faced. So let me begin by asking you to maybe reflect first on the relative initial success that India had or achieved in the fight against COVID. And it seemed that things were under control until March of this year. So if we could first begin there, what do you think explained that apparent success?
Well, Dan, you know, I wouldn't say initial success. I would say it was somewhere in the middle, because if you remember, initially, you know, March 24th to 25th, when Prime Minister Modi, you know, announced this lockdown, as you say, nationwide lockdown, with just 4 hours' notice, and it was one of the world's, I think it was the Oxford University which described it as one of the world's, probably the most stringent lockdown, and with no planning. If you remember, soon after, and in fact, you know, when I look at the photographs in my phone, the archived photographs, very similar photographs. Do you remember the long march of the migrants, people, you know, without anything, walking down highways?
Indeed, there were viral videos.
Yes, yes, yes. And I, in fact, wrote an essay on this, you know, the pandemic and the apathy for the Atlantic ideas. So that was also part of, if you take a long view, you know, over the last 1 year. So that was the initial phase. I think somewhere, say, around September, you know, we had when people were taken also completely off guard, right? We didn't know what this virus was, new virus was, you know, our scale. Around September, I think the numbers started dipping. I think, you know, the question you asked is the million dollar question, and it's been asked, and there is no neat answer to it. I think it's a confluence of factors. But certainly, I would say that it was a kind of triumphalism, you know, a lowering of guard at all levels. And here, I don't want to do both-sidism by saying the government and the people equally to blame. That, I think, is a slightly lazy way of putting it, because I see a slightly different difference between, say, the vegetable vendor down my street and you know, people whom we elect at the highest levels. You know, when, for instance, you know, this has been reported all over, when you see these huge, you know, election rallies, when you see this huge, you know, religious gatherings like Kumbh Mela, you know, and even the farmers' protests, actually, all this is being allowed. And I think definitely lowering the guard is the phrase we hear, but I think definitely what was also important was this mixed messaging that was going on. You know, I mentioned earlier about the triumphalism. You know, I think even as an individual, when we are in the middle of a crisis, we do worst case scenario planning, right? We don't do best case scenario planning. So to me, one very, very important thing about India, which none of us can afford to lose sight of, is the scale. So, you know, how can you forget that India has almost 1.4 billion people? So, for instance, I was just yesterday looking at, and I've mentioned this in my various columns, even November 2020, there was a parliamentary committee report which specifically talked about the second wave and the third wave. You know, now we are being told that, no, but we didn't think it would be so virulent. Now, on the basis of what? When you know you have the numbers, we are not a country which is, you know, 5 million population or 10 million population or 20 million population. Delhi, where I'm speaking from, is itself 20 million plus. So whenever we do planning, how did we not factor in this? So, for instance, when you allow huge crowds together and you are saying on one hand, the government, you know, that the government, the official messaging is fine, you know, there was definitely, it's like any medical doctor would tell you. But then simultaneously, you're having images of politicians, including star campaigners. You know, we've seen images from, say, West Bengal. There's been a multi-phase elections being announced where the star campaigners, including the prime minister, the home minister, the former health minister, you know, addressing these huge crowds. There's been this gloating about huge crowds gathering. What is an ordinary person supposed to think of that? And, you know, in India, as you know, we've always had these, you know, these exceptions being made. And I think in a public health, you cannot have exceptions. You know, the rule, and I've covered the HIV/AIDS epidemic, and I think this is a fatal flaw. The moment you start saying, you know, okay, there's a rule, but you can sort of not follow it during some time, or some people needn't follow it. I think that's where you start sinking. And I think there's many, many factors. And of course, the scale, which nobody could have, you know, that's globally, you know, nobody could have anticipated just how big it would be. But when we are taking risks, I think this is basically why we are here. I think in January, the Prime Minister in Davos, I think he was addressing a gathering, probably virtually, and he said that, you know, how we sort of, you know, it's kind of was really saying, you know, how great we are and we've done it. And I think while every country, every government, of course, will be proud of what they've done, triumphalism has no space in the middle of a pandemic. We don't know when this is going to end. You know, going by history of past epidemics and pandemics. So at no point, you can, at the most, you have to be humble. You can definitely say that you've done some good things, but this is not a competition, an Olympic kind of a joust where you are better than somebody, somebody's slipped up. I think this is also part of the, what I would say, has contributed to, you know, some sort of, as you mentioned, complacency and, you know, relaxed attitude, which crept in.
That is fascinating. You know, sitting very far away, but missing India every day. My initial worry, and I was really worried already in January, February, because I've been studying China and I usually am in China pretty often. And when I started, you know, looking at some of the reports coming out of China, but also seeing the impressive logistical capacity that China has to build hospitals in 10 days and all of that, I kept worrying about India and I kept worrying about the African continent, where I also study several countries. And to be honest, I was actually pretty impressed that the Indian state was able to enforce a lockdown at all. The very fact that something that ambitious would be announced and implemented, enforced, and there would be some sort of respect for that among the population, and that we could actually change people's behavior, people living in often in very congested circumstances. Cities are huge. People have large families, may not have enough space. Just the sheer, you know, magnitude of that exercise was confounding. I was so impressed initially. And of course, as the months went, you know, by, the report seemed to suggest that India had certain things under control. And then there was this gradual opening up. And as you were saying, one of the things that I kept wondering about, and, you know, I speak to my parents every day, they live in Kolkata. I kept wondering, how can you have this on and off kind of lockdowns, certain days on and certain days off? It's almost like the odd and even kind of policy in Delhi you have to control pollution. So I think you make a very good point there. You know, you have to aim for some sort of consistency and see it through. So I think that was one set of issues. But you were referring to also the Prime Minister's speech at Davos. And I suppose I can see why Indian politicians, ruling party politicians, felt the need to maybe boast a bit, because, you know, getting things under control in a country like India, I, you know, who would have thought that that was possible? So, you know, even I was interviewed on all kinds of media saying, what explains India's success? And I was extremely proud that India had somehow inexplicably got this under control. But since March, things have just exploded. And that kind of complacency and triumphalism, as you were referring to, in hindsight, looks extremely misguided. But I wanted to pick your brain on how you perceive the current kind of strands in the debate. What are the areas where people agree? And where do you think the major disagreements are? Is it related directly and exclusively to state inaction, not planning, not anticipating a second wave or a third wave? Or is it also, in addition, the fact that the Indian population let their guard down?
You know, India, I mean, the first thing I think to know about India, or to keep in mind as we talk, is that since 2014, or, you know, maybe a little bit before that, but accentuated since 2014, India is a hyper-polarized society. So every debate, you know, it is everything that we're talking about, including the pandemic, has to be seen through that lens. So it's kind of, and I've written about this, it's when polarization collides with pandemic, what happens? So it's very, very difficult to get a consensus on anything, right? Whether it's good, whether it's bad, because of the, you know, the lack of trust. Trust is kind of broken down, right? So, you know, your original point about, I think there's a difference between being proud of something and triumphalism. As an Indian, and I've been covering health, for instance, I'm extremely proud of the fact that, you know, we were the world's largest, I think we are still the largest vaccine manufacturer by Dose Serum Institute. And even during the HIV/AIDS epidemic, for instance, it's Indian-made generic, you know, drugs which saved the lives of, you know, millions of Africans, for instance, not to mention Indians. So, I mean, those are very legitimate, you know, things to be proud of. But that's where I think, you know, when that justifiable pride, which should basically lead to a confidence, a quiet confidence, goes on to another level of this triumphalism, you know. And there, I think, when you talk about, you know, the strands of the debate, there is, it's, I would say there is no debate. Debate assumes that you're listening to somebody, to the other person, to the other point of view. I think what we're seeing is clashes. And this is because trust is broken down. So, you know, for instance, the people who say support the partisan to the ideology of the Bharatiya Janata Party, which was at the center, and in many other states, there is this kind of, you know, Mr. Modi can do no wrong. There's a whole supporters, and you know, it's an offline and online, you know, you would have met them, many people in the thing. And then there's the other people who are virulent critics of Mr. Modi. Now, the trust factor is there's almost, I would say, really no debate. And if you ever watch Indian television, I would say some channels, you would see nobody's listening to anybody, you know.
Indeed.
Screaming at each other. So the word debate you use, you know, is actually presumes that, you know, there's a kind of reasoned exchange where, you know, one person puts forward. And the reason why we have no trust, because alongside the pandemic, you have a lot of other things, or, you know, even preceding the pandemic, which is sort of consistently broken down trust. We've had this issue of, you know, majority versus minority, you know, labeling of groups of people as termites. You know, we know that, you know, from the highest in the lab, from, you know, top ministers. So this kind of thing, I think, during a pandemic, you have to get, and also the center state, as we see now, you know, there's this unseemly jousts between opposition rule states and the central government. Whether it's the vaccine policy, whether it's anything else, the states ruled by the opposition are saying they're not being consulted. They're not being consulted enough. That doesn't mean that, you know, there are no motions of consultative mechanisms are not, you know, they are being probably followed, but that's tokenism. So I think what is happening is that because there's lack of trust at multiple levels, as I said, center, state, you know, between communities, this kind of, you know, in a way impacts the pandemic response. Because, you know, I write on health. I covered the battle against India's battle against polio. And if I could, you know, give that example, everybody said India will not be able to, you know, win this battle. And if India doesn't win, whole of Southeast Asia doesn't, right? But we did it. In 2011, India was declared polio free. And I was covering that battle from, you know, from the stage when everybody had given up on India, and there were in fact some specific districts, and they happened to be minority, you know, with large Muslim population. And I remember writing a story for The Lancet where in one of these districts I had gone where things were very, very bad, and I asked a family, why don't you let your child take the polio vaccine? And you know what the person said? They said, you don't care about us any other time. You don't care if we die of, you know, typhoid, cholera, bad sanitation, poverty, but you only care if we get polio. We don't trust you. And for many communities, you know, who are marginalized, who are poor, who are in a way kind of, you know, stigmatized, the only face of the government they see is kind of the police, the security, the man in the uniform. They don't see health workers. Health infrastructure in India is not equitably distributed. But, you know, so the trust was a huge factor. But even amidst that, we won the battle against polio, not just because of the vaccine, that, of course, that I would call the hardware, but the software was working at community mobilization, you know, roping in religious leaders, you know, building, restoring that trust, you know, and it worked. And you know, we went through. So I think, as far as I remember, there weren't these unseemly jousts going on between the state and the center. When you have a pandemic, you cannot have multiple agendas. You know, you cannot have a cultural agenda. You cannot have all these other political agendas simultaneously. The pandemic kind of expects you to focus on it completely. One of the differences I see right now, and I think the holding of the election rallies is just one example. It isn't very clear to me why was it absolutely necessary to have all these state assembly elections, multi-phase elections. I mean, we talk about digital India. So why wasn't it, you know, why couldn't we have a virtual thing? Why? And then not just, you know, having these rallies, but literally encouraging these rallies. Kumbh Mela, you know, there was actually video competitions of your shot, you know, come and take a video of a thing. Even well, the health ministry is saying, please don't gather in crowds, wear your masks. So I think this mixed messaging, these multiple agendas, a lot of people said, you know, holding elections is a kind of, you know, if you can argue against that, this is subverting democracy. I think that's laughable, you know, that suggestion, because a lot of the people who are saying this have really no great record in upholding democracy in any other time, you know. So suddenly when they become the new champions of democracy, I'm kind of, I would take it with a huge bag full of salt. So I think the trust has broken down. And this is why the debate is essentially becoming a collision, not really a debate, which makes it very, very difficult. I'll give you an example from the farmers' rallies, you know, which I also attended, the farmers' protests. Now, actually, I was doing a story, not a political story, but an environment story about whether the new farm laws, you know, are going to solve any of the environmental problems of Indian agriculture. And it was for a Lancet Planetary Health. So I didn't really go into the political issues. But just off the side, I did notice a lot of farmers not wearing masks. And when I asked them, I realize why they weren't or why they were gathering. You know, there was again this distrust of the government. You know, I think when you give an message, the people who don't trust you will not follow it, you know, for a whole lot of other reasons, because they just think that you don't have their welfare in mind. And then the other factor also kicks in when you look at a leader as a messiah and kind of attribute almost superhuman, unreal powers, you know. I think there's also a problem because you're not really thinking rationally and you think that no matter what, there is this one man or two men or a group of people who will somehow see us through. So in such a kind of extreme, I would say, belief systems, it becomes very difficult to actually have that kind of debate that you're talking about.
You know, in my previous work on democracy and hunger and starvation in India, I found that one way in which I found politicians reacting was precisely what you said. It is this show of concern for certain issues, but not for others. It is this show of concern to prevent people from dying of starvation, but not doing anything to prevent people from having come to that situation where they didn't have enough food. So it is always this intervention at the very last phase of life, and just to prevent people or lift them above the starvation line, but keep them below the poverty line. So one of the conclusions I had, and I think I wrote about this more than 10 years ago, is this savior complex. You know, you have politicians coming in at the last moment, saving people and then leaving. And if any uncomfortable question is asked, you say, well, it is the previous government's fault or somebody else, international community, etc. But remember, at least I've done the job, I've saved you. And going back to this polarization that you characterize Indian society to be, I see your point. I take it that maybe it isn't a debate as much as a shouting match. And you know, it is easy to, in polarized societies, just like in the United States, to end up in echo chambers. One doesn't really want to hear somebody coming up with an alternative explanation. And, you know, when I've taught at Indian universities, whether it is in Chennai, in Mumbai, or also in Delhi or Kolkata, sometimes I've wondered the extent to which there is emphasis on critical knowledge, not one-sided knowledge, not one-sided acceptance. And one of my messages has always been, you know, there are many sides of a story and that one really must adopt a critical, independent, balanced approach rather than just coming up with a one-sided explanation. So what do you think, Patraleka? What do you think explains this affinity to simply adore and worship one leader or one side of the political spectrum without reasoning, without really looking at alternative evidence, without looking at alternative sources? How can one be so sure of one's perspective, one's decisions, and not even wonder, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's another way of looking at things.
Yeah, I mean, this is a thing, you know, which I think about a lot. And, you know, it's not that India hasn't had great critical thinkers, you know. I mean, Professor Amartya Sen.
No, I didn't mean that at all.
Yeah, I meant, you know, I think there are different reasons. So right now, as we speak, the cultural context is, you know, it's really a battle for the idea of India, right? So you have the pro, what they call Hindutva, against the old liberal idea of, you know, what they call Nehruvian India, but even if you don't call it Nehru, the plural. So I think there's this huge joust. For me, for instance, secularism, liberalism, pluralism, these are absolutes also, though normally I don't go into absolutes. Similarly, for people who are, let's say, proponents of Hindutva, you know, it is an absolute thing. So what happens is, in this context, when you disagree, and I've seen this a lot of the time as a, you know, as a journalist, as a woman journalist on social media and writing, because the moment you disagree, it's not just you're seen as somebody with a different point of view, but as the enemy, you know? And it doesn't even end always with being labeled as an enemy. But, you know, there have been cases of, you know, journalists being picked up under various, you know, security legislation, National Security Act. And remember that in India, everybody doesn't have the same levels of education, awareness, you know, exposure. So it's kind of very simplistic messages that if you are saying something, let's say, against the ruling dispensation or its ideology, if you're critiquing it, even during a time of crisis like this, you are necessarily the enemy. And if you have any international connections, you know, then even more so. And this is a very sort of it's kind of distilled into pithy one or two lines, and you're kind of carpet bombed with that message, and people absorb that, and I think this is where the problem comes, where, you know, disagreement means you are the enemy. And where does it come from? I've thought about this a lot, and I grew up in Kolkata, and my formative years, I would say, I mean, I actually gone to many schools in many cities in India, but Kolkata College and a major part of my schooling. I think it's a lot to do with the way our society, you know, our society is not, yes, we are a democracy and the constitution says everybody's equal, but it's a deeply hierarchical society, right? With gross inequities and with caste and class and, you know, all these other barriers, right? So I think in a grossly inequitous society, if you look at in a very micro, within a family, you know, it's the patriarch, it's the guy, he speaks, the others keep silent. And this, it's not just among the poor, even among the middle class. Very, very few households, and I mean, I was very privileged, exceptional. My parents were both sort of, you know, they were science people, and we could discuss anything and everything, and there were no taboos, you could read. Even in my college, I did English literature. We could actually ask whatever questions. But in many, many families, that's not the case. So you don't actually grow up with this sort of, I would say, obedience. You must obey authority. There's a certain deference. So when you do that, the authority, you know, it could be within the family. It could be within your work situation. Because I think there's a fear which undergirds this, that if you try to challenge authority, whether within the family or whether it's in your workplace or whether you're, and I don't mean challenge as necessarily going on an obvious collision course, you know, you are really going to be in a very, very bad situation. So what a lot of Indians see is that, you know, it's a much easier or better way is to sort of do the indirect. You try and make a deal with the system. I think Amartya Sen has mentioned this, where, you know, it's a kind of factional way that you're not really fighting for everybody to get a certain basic minimum. You just want, let's say, your group, your clan to get something. I think that may be one reason why, you know, when you're in a kind of a public place, and you're jousting, you're kind of scared, or you feel that there's too much to lose. Also, because we are a very populated country, you know, the competition, for everything, resource is very, very deep. I feel that there is a sort of a fear for most people that if you actually go on a collision course, or if you challenge authority at any level, or if you sort of try to stand out, there'll be huge consequences. Best best to fit in. Of course, there are lots of exceptions. And as I said, that India has a rich history of critical thinkers. And there are many, many people take at great personal risk to themselves, journalists, public intellectuals. They've lost their jobs. They've been punished, but they're still speaking out. We also remember the other thing. We don't have any social security. So, for instance, if I can use that to what's going on in the informal sector, informal sector, which is like the vast majority of Indians actually work as informal workers. What we saw last year, so these migrants, they lost their jobs. They didn't get salaries for, months on end. Even now, even when the recovery started, I noticed that even though outwardly, like the neighborhood where I live, South Delhi, is a reasonably nice neighborhood. This is before the lockdown, shops were open, marketplaces. But when you actually go and talk to people, you find that they're getting one third of their salary or half of their salary. Now you ask them, why are you putting up with this? They say, what choice do we have? We don't have any social security, unlike, let's say, most Western countries, certainly, Norway and Sweden. And so when you don't have any fallback option, I think that is also what contributes towards a certain fear, a reluctance to really take on the establishment. And you're always looking for this one-stop shop, somebody who will, like you said, savior, the guru. There's a very good reason why gurus and Bollywood, and I would say, you could actually use it, why gurus and Bollywood are so phenomenally successful in India, because the everyday life is so harsh and brutal, and not just during the pandemic, that you're desperately looking for this one-stop shop, who will take you out and give you this kind of, in a way, outsourcing thinking. And recently, I remember, I noticed this, and this got me a lot of my friends actually came down on me like a ton of bricks. Somebody had lost a family member, and I found the post on his Facebook very curious. He said, God snatched him from me. So I said, not necessarily to him, but generally, I said, it's an interesting way of putting things. God snatched, instead of saying so-and-so died because of lack of oxygen or lack of an ICU bed. So in a way, you're kind of outsourcing the responsibility to something which you cannot see. Or, it's a way, it's a kind of a valve that if you have no control over, what you have, then what's the point of, what's the point of agency? So I think there are many of these reasons. We are also a deeply religious society. So I think there's a lot of reasons which actually come together, which make you desperately look for, that's probably why authoritarian people have are across the world are becoming quite popular, and they're sort of gaining power, including in India. People, they are looking for this one-stop shop, this one savior. And if that savior happens to be a good speaker and kind of knows, what are your, there's also the politics of resentment. People have a lot of resentment towards a whole lot of things, If they can somehow manage to harness that, historical resentment, historical grievances, all of that, I think, is coming together.
When hearing you speak, I'm reminded of a couple of things. One is what my mother keeps saying, and she, when the few years that I spent in India with her before they sent me to boarding school, she kept mentioning, and she still does so, that whatever God does is for the best. This is one way of perhaps combating uncertainty. It's accepting the unacceptable, accepting certain things that you wouldn't accept in many other societies. So that's one set of issues. The other one is, I'm glad that you mentioned my guru, my mentor, Amartya Sen, who I've been inspired by. And, he has often highlighted the wonderful instrumental value of democracy in India, that one could have the intrinsic value of democracy, as in we like freedom and we cherish political rights. But it is that instrumental value that through public debate and discussion, having a free media, having critical debates in parliament, that's how the citizens of India are able to articulate their interests. And this plays out really nicely in relation to big, major, visible crises like famines that have not taken place in India since independence, whereas many other issues are somewhat couched or hidden away if it happens far away in the rural areas, affecting people that are not considered to be politically important. They may not gain the kind of attention that a very visible crisis does. And so, and of course, he's also mentioned, he's written a book on the argumentative Indian.
Yes.
So when I mentioned the idea of critical reasoning, etc., my intention was not to say that there is none of that happening. It was more about certain groups in the population, as you say, are swayed by populist leaders or by simplistic messaging. And in terms of democracy, as you're aware, the VDEM Institute that publishes this report from the University of Gothenburg recently made news headlines, right? And in terms of classifying India as an electoral autocracy. And this, of course, led to a lot of resentment and pushback, naturally enough, from the authorities in India, where there's been a lot of discussion as to whether India is democratic or not. How do you see that discussion? Did that attract a lot of attention among your colleagues and among journalists that India is now being seen, not just by VDEM, but also Freedom House and other think tanks, as losing that reputation that India's had uninterrupted, at least for many, many years, that India is the world's largest democracy? That hurts, doesn't it, for many Indians?
Absolutely, terribly. That question, yes, of course, has been intensely debated. But again, this discussion is also being seen through a prism of polarization, because it's the liberal, for lack of a better word, who are visibly worried, who are discussing it. Then there is the other group of people, and you know, I'm not getting into numbers, who see this as a concerted attack on Prime Minister Modi himself and his governance and India. And you see the narrative which I, and I'm just sort of articulating the other point of view, is that the rich world doesn't really want to see an India, a confident India. And this is one among several attempts to kind of push you down and level you down and, you know, essentially to kind of sneer at you. And there are a lot of takers for this argument, because they would then weave in maybe past instances where, yes, it has been true that, you know, international media has not always been, and I'm not talking about just the last 6 years, have been sometimes probably unjustifiably sneery or biased. So they would, you know, I mentioned this thing of politics of resentment. So there is a politics of resentment, and there would be this thing about, you know, the white man and the brown man, you know, that kind of the race debate, the first world, third world debate. So a lot of that is, you know, comes in, and then it's kind of distilled into this very, I think, is an oversimplistic thing about the world, the West doesn't really want India, or jealous or resent, because the locus of power is shifting to Asia, and these former colonial powers or former rich countries cannot bear to see other bright, confident Indians. So that's why they're trying to get at you. And people who are criticizing, or who are also, it's not just the VDEM Institute or others, it's, you know, Indians writing for Indian media, including in languages other than English, who are also pointing this out. They may not be internationally known, but it's not just that, you know, the dissident voices are only, you know, outside. But then they are labeled, and I think this is where it really worries me, of trying to, and I've seen this, you know, happening all the time, including to a lot of us journalists. It's this neat categorization, labeling, boxing you in as you are part of that camp, and you must be gaining something. So, for instance, you must have heard this term, or maybe you haven't, the Khan Market Gang. Have you heard this term?
Yes, I have, indeed.
Yes. So if you are critical of the government of Prime Minister Modi, the policies, the Hindutva, you're seen as, you're part of this elite, you know, the elite, westernized elite, who really had a lot of social capital prior to the sort of, you know, Mr. Modi coming to power, and it's always you're seen as you're feeling left out and rudderless, and you know, because you've lost your access to power, and therefore it's a kind of whining. You're framed as a kind of a whiner, and your only friends are people who are abroad, and you're basically irrelevant. And I think the funny thing, what I find in this whole discourse, there could be a few people like this, you know. I mean, I'm not completely discounting that, but what I find that we are uncomfortable, and I'm not saying that all of us, but some of us, I think India has a lot to be proud of, you know. And as an Indian, you know, I'm an Indian citizen. I live in India. I've worked in India for most of my life, though I've lived also in Europe. We have a lot to be proud of, and we can actually afford to be confident. We can afford to make, acknowledge our mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes, including, you know, rich countries, and even the made those mistakes even during the pandemic. So I don't understand this kind of, actually, it's a marker of great insecurity, because on one hand, if you say the West and their institutions are completely irrelevant, then simultaneously you cannot be, hyper jubilant when they actually say some nice things about you. Because if somebody's irrelevant, they're irrelevant whether they're saying good things about you or bad things about you. So I think this is a kind of an awkward situation where there is this small things, you know, about, you know, what so-and-so said, and, you know, handshakes, and, you know, we've seen this, you know, the body diplomacy when Prime Minister Modi meets these world leaders. There's a sort of exulting over that, and you know how India is fine. And he said something which I personally again felt a bit very, very uneasy about. I forget where he said it, but he said that prior to 2014, Indians were very ashamed of themselves, and we felt very inferior when we went abroad, but now we feel proud. And I can tell you, Dan, I've never felt inferior ever in my life. And I, the first time I went to the West, so to speak, it was in 1989 when I got a scholarship from the French government to study in Paris, and then traveled all over Europe. This was the year when the Berlin Wall fell. And this was, remember, pre-liberalization, when India was seen by many, many people as another poor country. When I went to Paris, yes, it was very obvious that it was a country with a far higher GDP than mine, and people were definitely better off, but I never individually felt inferior at any level. And I feel nobody can make you feel inferior without your consent. Just because somebody's richer or comes from a country with a higher GDP doesn't mean that they are superior than you. So to me, this remark was a very odd thing, because I don't agree that all Indians felt inferior, you know, before any time. But many people do feel. The other thing, which is actually goes down to what we were discussing earlier, about why we are not critical enough. I think we've not discussed this here, but maybe something to do with also our education system. Of course, there are exceptions. You know, there are these very, very good institutions like JNU or Delhi School of Economics, IITs, even the college which I think you and I both went, St. Xavier's. But by and large, it's by rote learning, right? You don't really learn how to develop an argument. And I think this is a problem, not just in the context of these huge political debates, but even, you know, in a very everyday situation, I've noticed, you know, even in media or in public sphere, like I used to debate a lot. People, they just think just slapping together some facts, or sometimes from very biased sources, that itself is an argument. And it's a little bit by training, right? You have to learn how to develop an argument, whatever you're saying. And it can be either way. And I think that's where, when you talked about debate, why debates don't take place, really, in the sense that I understand the term, is because each one, in many instances, people are just throwing their biases at each other, and they're not developing, they're not taking things to the logical conclusion. You know, you can't just pick up an argument and leave it halfway, and that's not a debate then. So I think this is, you know, this is an issue.
So a few years ago, I had an awful experience giving a talk at IIT Mumbai.
Okay.
Maybe it was almost a decade ago. I was invited to give a talk, and I was talking about human rights. I was talking about the Indian Supreme Court's decision in terms of the right to food case that I've been studying. I was talking about my own research. I was talking about Amartya Sen's research and presenting this. And 5 minutes into the talk, a senior academic from IIT Mumbai stood up and he said that he totally disagreed with me. And I, you know, I'm used to this. And so I said, on what grounds? He said, what you're saying is not true. And I tried to lay out my argument. I tried to show him the evidence. I referred to the literature. He says, no, I have 100 books in my office that say the opposite. So I said, okay, let's go and see what those books are. He didn't. He just kept disagreeing. And so we ended up having this rather unpleasant conversation between us rather than the talk that I'd planned. And later on, of course, he came up and he said there wasn't any evidence. He was just being difficult and he was showing off. And when I asked him to show me the evidence, there was nothing that he could show. And so what I was saying earlier is based on some of those experiences, Bhattalekha, where, you know, somebody wants to just make a point without really showing where the evidence is. But going back to this previous discussion of ours in terms of the elites, as you are perhaps termed to be, you're an English-speaking journalist, you travel, you have access to people, you live perhaps in a certain part of Delhi, close to Khan Market. Maybe that's where you shop.
No,
so,
actually,
okay.
I'm far away.
But if somebody hears you speak, I suppose they would assume you to be that elite. And let me be the devil's advocate here a bit, even though I agree with you. I feel that, you know, in many ways, for many years, India's elites were perhaps on occasion, or maybe often, seem to be very arrogant, telling the masses, this is how you should be, you know, speaking English. So this is how education should be. And, you know, somehow justifying their superiority in society. With the popularity of Prime Minister Modi and his party, it seems to me that it was the revenge of the masses against the elites, right? Saying, now it is our turn. You know, what did you do? We don't want you to continue with this Bengali Bhadralok mentality, saving us. We want to decide for ourselves. It is about time that our perspectives got more attention, not necessarily an agenda that is set by these elites. Can you relate to some of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's definitely a, you know, part of that is, you know, is the reason why we are here. But you see, this is where the cleverness comes in, because it is, as I said, the Mr. Modi's party is very, very good at messaging, right? Now, it's a bit of a reductionist view to reduce the people, the wide variety of critics into, you know, an elite, you know. So basically the narrative is that if you oppose Mr. Modi, you're necessarily part of this westernized Nehruvian elite, right? And who speaks English in a certain way, lives in, as you said, with the cultural. And that is definitely part of the story is definitely that. And I would say that, for instance, when we were growing up, we all went to, and, you know, you don't really choose, you know, the family to which you're born or the school which you get sent to. So I come from a very, very middle-class family, but professionals. You know, my mother and father both actually majored in physics, and my father was an engineer. So education, and, you know, among Bengalis, middle-class Bengalis, education was a passport. Education is what you really invested in. So even whether you could afford it or not, you were sent to good schools, right, and college. And you were told, even if you starve, you know, you will study and you will invest in education. Also, you know, many other parts of India, not just Bengalis. But when I was growing up, you know, in the school that I went to, even in the college, I just studied English literature. There was definitely this, I would say, social snobbery, which I personally am extremely, you know, uncomfortable with. When you actually judge a person just by their accent or where they stay or, you know, what their parents do. And I'm very, very glad. And that, you know, that's no longer, you know, your accent was really a marker of your access to many things, right? The way you spoke English, it's almost out of Bernard Shaw's My Fair Lady, you know. It was the British class system, right? And that was very, very wrong. And I'm very, very happy that that elite, who many people who even went to school and college with me, or among the people whom I grew up with, we were definitely in a bubble. And I would say that. And in a way, when I joined journalism, and the reason why I joined journalism, you know, I don't come from a family of journalists. When I joined journalism in the 80s, to get like 600 rupees per month, and it was like starvation, right? You couldn't support. The reason why, and I chose to not stay with my parents, come to Delhi, and that absolutely had no relatives, no contacts, nothing, and literally almost on starvation, I was living in a room which was the size of my bathroom, current bathroom, is because I didn't want to go through life meeting people just like me. I had this terrible fear that that just might be the case. And I'm very glad that that social snobbery where you were completely judged by your accent, that is less and less. But I think it's a bit, you know, it's a specious argument actually to say that all dissent, all disagreements with the current dispensation is only confined to this elite. It is convenient to put it like that, to the Khan market elite. Now, if you know, there's a lot of the, for instance, the movements, the civil society movements. For instance, last year, the year before, we had these, you know, against the CAA, the Citizenship Amendment Act. Many of the people in the crowd, you know, they were not elite, and they are even today. Because we are English speaking, because the international media only, you know, picks up on English speaking journalists, English speaking articulate journalists, maybe people like me, it doesn't mean we are the only ones who are, you know, dissenting. There is other. It's just that we have it's easy for us to amplify our voice. But I think it's extremely, it's a specious argument to reduce all dissent to the English speaking elite who are only, you know, they say Khan market and the kind of social snobbery that is definitely was part of the piece. But that has been going down. Like when I was growing up, as I said, Calcutta, the city, which was sort of, you know, in various clubs, you know, it really mattered, you know, your table manners, you know, whether you put elbow on the table or not. I think that's gone. It's more and more, I would say, that the composition of the elite has changed, you know, and it actually precedes Mr. Modi, because even the, you know, with the various, the OBC, the reservations for the, what we call the other backward classes, I think it's a kind of a new elite. But we must also, when we talk about elites, I think we must also interrogate what this elite does, because it's again very simplistic to just say the elite versus the non-elite. So the new elite, in many ways, if the old elite was very contemptuous of people who didn't quite have the right accent or the manners, etc., the new elite, we don't see. There is a definite, a tremendous apathy towards, let's say, people who are, poorer, marginalized. I mean, you know, this whole thing about the secession of the successful, you know, the secession of the successful. So the reason, you know, to go back to why people feel offended when India's image is under attack, it's not India's image, it's middle class India, you know, because this thing about the very successful country, which is, this is the middle class's calling card, the upper middle class's calling card. So when they go abroad, you know, it's nice to be, okay, I understand it at one level, but the same, you know, the same elite, the new elite or the old elites don't really care about what's going on, to the vast majority of people, thousands, like you mentioned, you know, about people who are starving, people who don't have health infrastructure. When was the new elite or the old elite, barring honorable exceptions, really talking about that? And my personal experience, as I said, journalism has, I wouldn't say radicalized, but it's taken me out of my bubble. I write on things like health, social justice. It means going to villages, going to, you know, informal settlements. I recently did a talk on, you know, walking through, you know, basically Delhi slums.
Yeah, I saw that on Twitter.
Yeah. So, you know, and I started off not by wanting to be a do-gooder or to change, but simply out of curiosity. You know, a lot of the problem, a lot of the issue, like I even taught in Indian universities, part-time journalism. I find one of the problems is that a lot of the middle-class Indians, you know, when they really have no exposure to outside their middle-class milieu. Now, the middle-class milieu is also fraught with a lot of challenges. You know, if you don't have contacts, if you don't have pedigree, if you don't have social capital, I'm talking about the average middle-class person, getting a good job, getting a decent standard of living is an uphill struggle. So the sort of feeling is that, you know, like my life is tough enough now. I can't be really bothered to, you know, worry about everybody else. I don't have that. And then they're saying, you know, the West, because they're a post-affluent society, you know, rich countries who basically have no problems. They can afford to, you know, cry about, you know, the lot elsewhere. But we are in the, you know, we are still busy climbing the ladder. And, you know, just to give you an example, right now, Delhi is in news, India is in news because of this huge oxygen emergency. You must have read about that, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, I actually wrote a column for a Hindi newspaper that I am absolutely in sympathy, and I've been spending a lot of my waking hours trying to connect, in my lockdown state, people who need help to people who can provide help. But part of, there's also a bitter irony, or is a harsh, the brutal truth is that right now, even though, you know, one really feels bad for the people who are suffering, not being able to access healthcare, you know, is not a new story, right? People dying because they could not get to a proper health facility in time, or even oxygen for other reasons, not just COVID. This is an ancient, ancient story, but it's getting a lot of play because it's happening in the cities, right? With people, also with people who have access to internet, you know, Twitter. So, you know, their struggles, their grief, their despair, as I've said, their anger is, you know, is are being platformed now, but there are millions and millions of people, you know, who are in remote, you know, areas who don't have these platforms, and their struggle, their access to health. Many, that, you know, India has the largest number of newborn deaths, for instance, you know, a very large number of infant deaths. One third of our children are under 5 are stunted, right? So many of these things, they will never be able to really lead their life optimally, because as you know, that when you're malnourished, it's not just your physical, that you just physically don't grow, even your brain is handicapped. So you cannot then compare somebody who's been right in the beginning, you know, in the first initial years, not getting enough nutrition, with somebody who's been very well fed and, you know, brought up, and say, you know, this other one is, the well-fed person is more meritorious, because the other one really didn't have any chance. But where are these issues? You know, it's yes, I think we're getting a lot of some of that now in the media. But the very fact that we, you know, it gets down to what is development, that traditionally the conventional narrative of development, or what is development, has been roads and bridges and highways and, you know, the sort of the visible things, right? And now we've also added statues and, you know, stadiums and spectacle. But we never cared how these other millions and millions, whether it's the new elite or the old elite, how, what happened to them, because it was really like when we blame Western countries and justifiably about not really caring about what's happening into developing, you know, do you really care what's happening in, you know, Niger or, you know, some part of Africa or in Kalahandi, do you really care? I think even the middle class, you know, and I think India maybe not the only country where we're also as distanced. And I think we need to be curious, we need to be engaged, because, you know, one thing the pandemic is doing is it's really exposing your inequalities and your fault lines. And I think it's going to make it worse unless you really kind of pay attention. And this is what I think, that the new elite, the old, you would need to be, you know, it's not about changing the world, but at least, you know, we got down to at least being aware. And there, as I said, journalism has kind of made me, taken me out of my bubble. And you know, these physical exposure, you know, to people, to spending time with them, weeks. I've also done a lot of other documents with UN and things, you know, spending a huge amount of time. It tells you how privileged you are. And though I don't believe in being in this permanent state of guilt trip, you know, whether you are, and even if I was born in a Western country, I don't think I'll be permanently guilt trip. But I think awareness, recognizing your privilege and the advantages, you know, which accrue because of that, is very, very important. In fact, I would say that's the starting point of any kind of engagement, you know, public action.
One final set of issues that we could perhaps briefly discuss has to do with the topic that we began discussing an hour ago, the Indian state's ability to address major visible crises such as COVID, or perhaps some would say it's an invisible crisis, but certainly now it looks like it is extremely visible with all the funeral pyres, all the photographs we are seeing. So on the one hand, of course, Patraleka, you know, I've been studying how democratic institutions, Indian institutions are very good at certain things. We were discussing earlier about early warning. You know, the media can provide early warning. You have political parties criticizing governments. And this is, of course, Amartya Sen's argument of public action really helping resolve certain problems. But much of what we've discussed today in terms of health, in terms of hunger, in terms of schooling, in terms of elite politics, these are not new. They've been around for a long time. You mentioned the HIV/AIDS issue and polio. And there are all of these other things, other problems in addition, like, you know, it could be employment generation programs. It could be food for work programs. You know, it could be gender policy. You name it. One of the things that I've noticed is that India often has some very impressive, ambitious, very expensive social protection programs. You mentioned the absence of the welfare state. Yes, but there are all of these innovative programs. It could be ICDS or the public distribution system. All of this has been in place. But nonetheless, the problems often are, or a lot of people would say the problems are at the implementation phase. What does all of this say for the future of the Indian state's ability to address major crises in the future? How do you see the government responding in this politically polarized situation, in this situation where anybody saying or pointing out anything that is perceived to be critical is sometimes easily dismissed?
In the short term, to be very honest, I'm not very, very hopeful in the short term. And I would say that, you know, last year, as I was saying, at this time, look at a lot of the images, and it seems like a real eerie sense of deja vu, you know, that the fear is back, the uncertainties are back. And sometimes we, you know, I ask what, and I recently wrote a column about lessons not learned. The first time round, you know, and I think this is true of many things, you could say that, okay, it was a mistake, you were taken off guard. But more than 1 year down the line, you know, if you're still making exactly the same kind of mistakes, what does it say about you? And I will give you an example of, let's say, the migrant population, you know, the informal sector, as you say, which is, you know, again, more than 80%, I think it's almost 90% of the workforce. Now, this is, again, something, it's not just the government, but even the vast majority of middle-class Indians seem to not recognize it. And last year, when we had this long march, it's like everybody has suddenly discovered the informal sector or migrants. They're everywhere. But, you know, it's just that they were visible. It took you just because they were walking down to this kind of extreme imageries, right? It's only that jolted you, but they were always there. And I asked at that time, and I'm still asking these questions through my writings and speaking, that what did we do for these people? And, you know, why did they leave? Because they have no certainties. They have no, you know, contracts. They know nothing. Why are they doing these jobs? Because they have no options, right? The land cannot sustain them. And there have been all these reports, you know, any number of reports and suggestions, including by, you know, ones where, you know, the governments have commissioned, saying that, oh, they should have some basics, you know, their food and their accommodation, some basics should be given to them. But again, nothing. So I think somewhere it's not just at the level of the Indian state, but in a way, Indian state also reflects the Indian society or the way it's going, you know. I think equity and trust are going to be two major issues. And I mean, it's easy to kind of dismiss them as, you know, very idealistic, but I think it's absolutely critical because, as you said, in normal times, what we tend to do is we, you know, just like middle-class Indians, or many of us, when we drive down the road, we put up our glasses, right? And we don't notice these people, you know, outside, you know, begging or you know, the street urchins and the sort of starving. And usually the first cultural shock when you go to a Western country is that even though they're poor, even poverty is not so, you know, it's not so obvious. It's not so, sometimes I would say it's terrible. It's very uncomfortable. So the fact that we kind of normalize a lot of things which are happening to people who are far less privileged to us. You mentioned, you know, ICDS and, you know, there's MNREGA and these are very, very important schemes. But, you know, just to be able to keep your body and soul together is not enough, right? When did we actually, as a society, really want them all, everybody to do well, optimally? So I think the Indian state, what we do for the most vulnerable I think is going to be key, because this number of the vulnerable is really increasing. And I also see this as interconnected. Quite apart from the moral argument, I think there's also a very practical argument. And I think a contagious disease really shows this up. And I will also give you an example of 1994 Surat. If you remember, India had this huge plague, 1994 Surat. Now, what Surat, when he had this plague, it didn't really matter whether you were posh or poor. Everybody got affected. And even business, because the migrant workers started leaving. But Surat used that to reboot itself and have a good public health. But again, I believe the city, you know, it's again being sort of coming apart. I mean, it was really, I haven't been to the city for a long time. But if you don't see the connections, that if you completely, like in a contagious disease, you know, what happens in the informal settlements, in the villages, the lack of health infrastructure, the lack of, you know, basic facilities, water, sanitation, ultimately affects you, the privilege. If you think you can live in a bubble, you can't, because a virus doesn't really respect, you know, they don't care your social or cultural or any other kind of boundaries. So if you don't see the interconnectedness, and if the state and the people, you know, the people are the ones, we elect our politicians. If we don't make these, for instance, you know, the right to universal health care, I think this is very basic. It really pains me to find, and it's again, this is pre-pandemic. We've had many of these legacy issues, which are just getting exacerbated, right? So we are right now talking about what is happening in the cities. And I recently wrote a column about what is India's oxygen policy for the villages. We don't even know. Why do we assume that it will never hit the villages? What is the health infrastructure in the villages, especially in populous states like Uttar Pradesh and Bihar? Even in the best of times, you know, things are, you know, not so good. So I think if we don't see the interconnectedness, I think then in the short run or in the medium run, I think things are bad, because, you know, these graphic images, there's also a certain fatigue which will set in after some time. People, like you mentioned, you know, funeral pyres or you know, howls of grieving people who are losing their families. After a point, people will just switch off, you know, and they just say, okay, let me just look after myself and my family. And I really don't care what's happening to the world. What happens to all the, you know, the screams and the howls will just go unheard. So, but I think it's very important to realize that our fates, our, you know, destinies are really connected, and that a virus, you know, whether you're posh or poor, at somewhere, you know, it's connected. If, for instance, you know, during the first lockdown, I heard that many people, middle class people, weren't really paying their domestics when there was a lockdown. And I think that's terrible. They don't have workable contracts. If you're going to say that, you know, your life doesn't matter, or your, you know, how you, your livelihood doesn't matter, I think then they say that if you don't care for us, why should we care for you? That's, again, it's a question of trust and solidarity. And I think these are actually not just moral arguments. Of course, they're moral arguments, but this is also part of, you know, important elements of a pandemic response. And even as we speak, when we see countries which are kind of, you know, managed reasonably well, are where, you know, social equity, you know, trust, I think it's much more. I mean, you know, you would know about this more living where you are, but I think these are important elements.
Patraleka, it was such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan. It was great to be on your show.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please spread the news among your friends and share it on social media. The Twitter handle for this podcast is Global Dev Pod.
Thank you for listening to In Pursuit of Development with Professor Dan Banik from the University of Oslo's Center for Development and the Environment. Please email your questions, comments, and suggestions to inpursuitofdevelopment@gmail.com.